From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we break down criminal charges filed against four more people in the Flint water crisis, including two emergency managers. But doesn't the state's law protect them?
It protects them from being sued, but it's not clear that it protects them from criminal charges.
Continuing the conversation with two of the Flint water fighters, Leanne Walters and Mark Edwards.
If you actually do the right thing, it usually turns out for the best, and I think that's the case here.
I will never trust a water source again just because I'm told to.
A new children's book tells the story of a soldier's Christmas morning homecoming.
It's a psalm to the beauty and joy of Christmas, and the most beautiful thing about Christmas is family being together, and that doesn't always happen with our soldiers.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Attorney General Bill Schuette today unveiled a new batch of criminal charges in the Flint water disaster. Charged today are former Flint emergency managers Darnell Early and Jerry Ambrose, along with Flint officials Howard Croft, he was superintendent of public works, and utilities administrator Dorothy Johnson. This brings the total number of people charged by Schuette to 13. Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning is back with us again. Peter, the two EMs, Darnell Early and Jerry Ambrose, charged with false pretenses and conspiracy, these are both 20-year felonies, along with misconduct in office and willful neglect of duty. But doesn't the state's emergency manager law protect them?
Well, it protects them from being sued, but it's not clear that it protects them from criminal charges. Typically, some type of grant of immunity would not be done in a statute, but instead would be approved by the attorney general and entered by a court. So while they do have the civil side immunity, it's not clear that they have the criminal immunity, although certainly that's something their attorneys are going to raise.
So that's certainly going to be an interesting test of the emergency manager law as the attorney general goes forward with this case.
Oh, absolutely. And you're going to have challenges to the charges, any number of them, because there are a lot of different legal arguments here, whether they have the type of office that falls within the misconduct in office crime. And then you have this very interesting new charge that we've seen here, the false pretenses charge, one that hasn't been used against any of the other defendants related to the water crisis.
Yeah, what does that mean legally when we say false pretenses? What does it mean?
Well, the crime of false pretenses, traditionally, one of the theft offenses, like larceny or embezzlement, false pretenses is when you lie to someone to get them to transfer property to you. So if I lie to you about how much I'll pay you or the validity of a check, and you give me the title to your car, that's false pretenses. So usually it's theft. Here, though, and the statute is broad, here the claim is they lied to get the bonds issued and that was used to obtain money from the bond purchasers. This is not the typical way that the statute is used, but it is a very broad provision. So their conduct might fit in under it, but I certainly expect to be an immediate challenge that this has nothing to do with theft by the defendants.
Howard Croft and Dorothy Johnson also charged with conspiracy and false pretenses. Again, both 20-year felonies. They were heading the public works and utilities departments when this lead contamination happened. Why do you think they're facing the same charges as the two EMs? Because weren't they just following orders?
Yes and no. I think to a degree they were. They were told to get this done, but the devil is in the details. And it was how they were trying to get the new KWA, the new Water Authority plant, up and running. And to get the money for it, they played fast and loose. And indeed, all four defendants are accused of playing fast and loose with the reason for the bond issuance and how the money was going to be used. And that's the basis for this charge, that essentially they lied. Typically, in these types of cases, you find a lie and then build your case out from there.
Read the tea leaves for us, if you can, Peter, as you look over the charges now filed against 13 people. Is there a pattern that you can pick out and discern?
These are not going to be easy cases. The pattern here is what the Attorney General and Todd Flood, the special prosecutor, have focused on, is trying to show misstatements or lies even by these different defendants, and to paint a picture of them as not just playing near the edge by overlooking or not acting properly and getting the water for Flint, but actually taking steps, active steps, toward misleading others who might have been able to prevent this. So this is a case that is built around misinformation by these defendants and even outright lies by the defendants to try to show that they're bad people. And of course, that's what every prosecution is, to show that the defendant is a bad person. That's going to be, I think, their path to try to do this.
As a former prosecutor, are you feeling things kind of lining up, or is this a path that you could have seen yourself following as a former prosecutor?
There aren't a lot of paths to try to go after officials like this who did not enrich themselves. That's always what you look for, and that has real jury appeal, when someone acts in a way to benefit themselves. We don't have any indications of that. So this is really a case about not acting properly with the authority they have. And so you have statutes here or crimes, misconduct in office, willful neglect, false pretenses in this case. They're trying to stretch them to cover what happened. It was always an issue here of, could the Attorney General find real criminal conduct? In other words, something that's going to strike a juror as, hey, this isn't just bad management, but this is criminal conduct. I still don't know whether they're over that threshold yet.
Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning. As always, Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much.
NOLA Gals by Barbara Rebick was published in 2015. It honored the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and it received 5 major awards in the young adult categories. This year, Rebick wrote a play for young people called Turbulence. It was based on her own novel. Writer Anne-Marie Oman has this review.
NOLA Gals, the novel, is about strong-hearted and vulnerable Essence, a Black girl whose family is caught in the throes of Katrina. Essence leaves home her mother and grandmother and the family's beloved dog, Old George, as the waters crest in the Ninth Ward. Essence and her little sister are handed off to rescuers while the others wait or scatter, or worse. Frantic and frightened about her family, Essence still manages to care for her sister as they make their way first to the Superdome, where conditions further traumatize them. Then on to Houston's Astrodome, where they join a handful of refugees and form a rough community in the bleachers. Meanwhile, strong-hearted and selfish Grace, on suspension from her expensive private school, is taken by her psychiatrist father to the Texas Astrodome to hand out water. With her, she carries a school journal and her reading homework, To Kill a Mockingbird. She has little intention of helping refugees, but when she encounters the cluster of people in Row G, she finds herself reading to them from To Kill a Mockingbird. The device of a book within the book is a sophisticated literary turn that helps frame issues and develop deeper themes. In NOLA Gals, Rebick adeptly describes the different reactions the white suburban girl and the Black girl from New Orleans have to this pivotal book. Of course, Grace's and Essence's paths cross again until at last Essence and her sister come to live for a time with Grace's family. This move could abound with the cliches of false charity and white girl rescues black sister themes, but Rebick is more realistic. While the girls do like each other, the transition is not easy, and Rebick maintains the integrity of both girls without trapping them in predictable niceties. However, when Essence enters Grace's school, complications multiply. There, they encounter the bigotry and racial slurs that force Grace and Essence to crisis, and where at last the two girls do part, but not for the reasons you might expect. The book abounds with stylistic variations. For example, before leaving the Astrodome, Grace had given Essence her empty homework journal. Essence uses it. Thus, the book shifts from third-person point of view to Essence's first-person journal entries to Grace's entries in her own journal. To further enrich literary texture, Rebbe includes flood signs, a school essay, a persuasive speech, letters to survivors from strangers, descriptions of lost pets, notes about where people might be found. If you see this sign, tell, as well as cinematic scenes of the suburban party where adults hatch the plan to oust the NOLA girls and, in a bizarre throwback to the 50s, ban the book To Kill a Mockingbird. The multi-genre approach allows us to see multiple points of view and explores how we help or don't, who rescues whom, how compassion is executed, and what it means to mature in places of hostility. This makes NOLA Gals a powerful teaching book. Not only does it encourage young people to speak openly of racial issues, but is full of models that teachers need. By the way, the NOLA Gals website features free resource materials. NOLA Gals has a positive but complicated ending, an ending that does not answer all the questions. Turns out, not all these folks are all good. But they are good in ways we appreciate and understand in light of the tragedy and injustices of Katrina. Rebbe's serious and refreshing tale is an important one for young readers, and she is executing some fine literary citizenship by encouraging young readers to discover and explore the impact of Hurricane Katrina. If the play version of NOLA Gals holds the same inspiration, our young people's theaters should be on the lookout for the exciting stage version, Turbulence, in which not one adult character appears. Watch for it.
Anne-Marie Oman is a memoirist, essayist, poet, and playwright. Her most recent book, Love, Sex, and 4-H, won the Next Generation Indie Award for Best Memoir 2016. Her book review is part of her ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find it and others at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We've learned that General Motors will cut the second shift at its Detroit Hamtramck assembly plant next March. Roughly 1,200 workers will be affected. This comes on the heels of GM's announcement that five of its U.S. assembly plants, including Detroit Hamtramck and Lansing Grand River, will shut down for anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks in January, and that temporarily idles over 10,000 workers. Detroit News Business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Daniel, you say Detroit's automakers may be in danger of becoming victims of their own success. How so?
Well, people are snatching up their trucks and SUVs like there's no tomorrow. I mean, we're in an operating in an environment right now that is running at record pace, roughly about 17 million units. I think they expect to close the year. And a lot of people believe that next year's going to be just as strong. Where it's not going to be strong is in the car business. So where you have, and what General Motors is doing is clearly making a move on the car side of the business and saying, hey, we've got enough inventory out here. We're not going to keep building these products, because if we do that, we're going to have to put a lot of money on the hood to incentivize these products, and we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing here, I think, is both the discipline of General Motors management and also the disciplining effect of the market. There's no question that low gas prices are driving demand for trucks and SUVs. But the other thing that's happening is that SUVs are not just Suburbans and Expeditions anymore and Explorers. They're Escapes, and they're smaller products that are coming out from the major manufacturers, essentially in some cases compact and even subcompact SUVs, because people want the utility. And they're also getting some much better fuel economy at the smaller sizes. And you put the whole thing together, I think the market is clearly turning away from cars.
So here we have Americans seeing the gas prices sliding down, although it did bump up a little bit in the past couple of weeks.
Right.
But we remember now how Americans are saying, oh, boy, we do love SUVs, no matter what the size. And we love our pickups. Not so much those energy-conscious little hybrid EVs that the Obama administration has been trying to push us all towards.
Yes, those pesky consumers. They're not buying, they're not buying what Washington tells them to buy. Look, I think you're seeing in the industry, people are making bets that this is a long-term trend. One of the biggest impacts on the global energy markets has been the entrance in a big way of American energy production. And that's had a major impact on supply and therefore on price. And I don't think people think that this is something that's going to end next month or next year. One of the pushes you're already seeing from the automakers is going to the Trump people and saying, look, we need to consider softening some of the tough fuel economy regulations that were established by the Obama administration, and frankly were pushed through at a time when Detroit particularly was not in a position to argue.
Mm-hmm.
And they were essentially taken advantage of, and they got what they wanted and have been pushed and pushed to hit these numbers. Now you have a situation where with car sales flagging, it's going to make it even harder to hit those numbers. You said at the top about what's happening in Detroit Hamtramck, I would point out to people that that's where the Chevrolet Volt comes from, which is an extended range hybrid vehicle. It's not selling, nor are some of the other cars selling in the ways in which they had hoped. The sale of smaller cars is what helps a manufacturer achieve tougher and tougher and tougher federal fuel economy regulations. And if you're not selling those cars, it's going to be harder and harder for you to get to those numbers. It's the tension between intention of regulators and intention of consumers in the marketplace, and they're opposing forces right now.
And as you point out in your column today in the Detroit News, the Obama administration has just doubled down on that tough 54.5 mile per gallon by 2025 standard.
Yeah, I happen to have been with the CEO of one of the companies the night that that happened, and I asked this person about it, and I said, what do you think? And they just looked at me and kind of just said, very disappointing. But I think that was being diplomatic. Mm. There was a lot of outrage on the part of the industry because they have seen this phenomenon that we're talking about shaping up for some period of time. I mean, that's what they're paid to do. And they've seen it coming, and then you lay on top of it a Trump win, and they believe that the regulatory environment is going to change somehow in Washington, and probably in more in favor of business than in favor of the regulatory regimes that have been prosecuted for the last 8 years. And that's why they're so frustrated, because this looked like an attempt, and I think it clearly was, by the Obama administration to say, okay, we're going to cement this thing, and we're going to put it in a situation that's going to be very difficult for you to change it.
I just have to say, though, what about consumer amnesia? Because does anyone expect these fuel prices to stay low? I mean, one big bounce in oil prices, and people are going to be weeping the blues as they fill up their SUVs and pickups at the gas pump.
Well, that's true. And I think some people, I don't think everybody buys a vehicle based upon the fuel economy. You're right, that could be possible. But remember, what's really changed in all of this is American energy production. And mm-hmm. and the Americans have become one of the largest energy producers in the world. And I think the expectation is that that's probably going to continue. So a lot of people in industry and in the auto industry and people who watch the auto industry believe that the environment we're in, it's more likely to stay closer to $2 and $2.50 than it is to get it $4 and $4.50. I think that's the expectation for the mid, or certainly the near and midterm. Now, long term is a different issue. And as you know, we've been talking a lot this year about mobility. And what's happening at the same time that all this is going on is everybody is focused on mobility, which means electric drive, which means autonomous vehicles, self-driving. That's a whole nother realm. But that is not what accounts for all of the revenue and profit in these companies right now. Mobility is sucking down a lot of investment, forward investment, but it's not delivering dollars to the top line or the bottom line. And what does that is the sale of pickup trucks, SUVs, crossovers, and to a lesser extent, cars.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
A children's book can be filled with wisdom and a message that resonates with readers of all ages. That's certainly the case with Traverse City-based writer Bill O. Smith's new children's book, 4 a.m., December 25. It's a story of a very special gift for a little girl. That gift arrives in the very early hours of Christmas morning when her soldier dad finally comes home. Bill O. Smith is here with us now. Bill, welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
This is really a story about a homecoming that truly is a Christmas gift, isn't it?
Yes, it's a psalm to the beauty and joy of Christmas, and the most beautiful thing about Christmas is family being together, and that doesn't always happen with our soldiers, so that's what it's about.
And what led you to say, I want to do this story, I want to write a story about a soldier trying to get home for Christmas? What was the inspiration?
My father, he told me he was a weatherman. He signed up shortly after Pearl Harbor and was in the Army Air Force for 5 years and spent time away from home, but said, I was a weatherman in Mitchellfield, New York. And only after he passed did I hear from his buddies who said, You mean he didn't tell you that we flew in unarmed air patrols over the North Sea to map out weather for bombing runs and that kind of thing? And he never said that. You know, the heroes are buried overseas, and he went on with his life and was grateful. And I both mourn that a little bit, but I'm so grateful for that humility, and I wanted to do something to honor him and to honor all veterans and all who serve others with strength and kindness.
And in your dad's honor, you're donating all profits from this book to some veterans organizations. What groups did you choose and why?
One is a local group up here. I live up in the Traverse City area, our local VFW Post Relief Fund. And the other three are national groups. The way I chose them, I went on to Cherry Navigator, and any four-star charity organization that was a veteran organization I wrote to. And four-star means 90% or more of the profits go to directly to the veteran services. And I said, this is what I'm doing. I've been pretty successful author with children's books, and this one I want to give to you. But I'm an old-fashioned guy. I like dinner bells and clothes drying on the line. And if you're interested, please write me a real letter with a real stamp and real handwriting on it. And so three of those organizations wrote me back. One is called Air Force Enlisted Village, which basically serves indigent wives, widows of Air Force men. It used to be Bob Hope Villages down in Florida. Mm. Wonderful organization. Air Warrior Courage Foundation serves injured soldiers and their families, and our Military Kids Incorporated, which serves kids who are feeling a sense of loss or having some trouble with their parents either being gone or perhaps deceased.
I have to ask you about the story is wonderful, but so are the illustrations by Glenn Wolf. Tell us a little about Glenn. Beautiful illustrations.
Glenn is a Traverse City native. Please, ladies and gentlemen, go to his website. You'll see these wonderfully detailed illustrations, mainly nature illustrations that he does. But yes, I needed someone of his caliber. I always say I could be Shakespeare, but these are picture books. Mm-hmm. And you better have someone who can tell stories in the pictures. And these pictures tell a story. For instance, 4 a.m. only has about 100 words in it. And if you just read the text, you wouldn't even know it's about a soldier. There is never a mention of a soldier. There's so much detail. And that's what Glenn is able to capture.
I would absolutely urge everybody to go to BillOSmith.com and find out more, again, realizing that all proceeds from the book benefit these four-star veterans organizations. The book is 4 a.m. December 25, telling the story of a little girl, really a family, waiting for the only Christmas gift they really want, Soldier Dad, coming home. Bill, it's a great book. Thank you so much for sharing it with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Merry Christmas.
It's that time of the year again, the time when dictionaries come up with their words of the year. Stateside's Lester Graham spoke with University of Michigan Professor Ann Curzan, co-host of That's What They Say, here on Michigan Radio.
Okay, I looked at the list, and I'm thinking, well, this is going to be a fun show. Or maybe not.
I know. The words of the year that are being announced are not a very happy lot. I need to start by backing up and talking about these words of the year votes and where they come from.
Yeah, who gets to decide that?
Yeah, well, and I want to give a shout out to the American Dialect Society. I will admit I'm a member of the American Dialect Society, which started the idea of the word of the year vote back in 1990, and it was based on Time's Person of the Year. And we started voting. We still do this, and we vote the first week of January. In other words, we wait for the year to be over. Because you never know what could happen linguistically in December.
Right.
But since then, we've had dictionaries start to do the same thing, and they bring out their words of the year in November and December. So Oxford Dictionaries does a word of the year, Merriam-Webster, dictionary.com, Collins. So we've got a few of these, and some of them have now been announced. Oxford Dictionaries got some attention because their choice was post-truth.
Which has been talked about a lot this year in a way that for journalists is really disappointing because we kind of embrace the truth. So who decides that? How do they decide that? I mean, do they have a board of editors at the dictionary that decides that? And is it based on frequency? Is it based on...
It's both of those things. So it is chosen by the editorial staff. They are looking at frequency, what words are getting looked up, where are there particular spikes? Because there are some words that get looked up a lot, but they always get looked up a lot. And then you'll see spikes on particular words. And post-truth was getting a lot of attention this year. I think one of the other things they're noting is that this year, post-truth started to show up without quotation marks. That when words are first coming in, people will say it is, quote unquote, post-truth to signal this is new. They may define it. And now we're using post-truth as if everyone knows what it means.
Well, if everybody's looking it up, can you define it for us?
So I'll give you Oxford Dictionary's definition. And they say it is relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief.
There we are.
Yeah. Now, there's been some interesting discussion about this to say that appeals to emotion are actually not new. That, of course, in political discourse, we've often appealed to people's emotions, and emotions can have a lot of sway, often as much as or more than fact. So there have been some people saying, OK, let's just make sure we say that the idea of appealing to emotions is not entirely new.
You have another entry here. It's just as cheery as the last one, if not more so.
Dictionary.com. And Dictionary.com is giving us, as the word of the year, xenophobia. Yeah.
Which also is understandable why it's brought up this year. So why don't you define or give us their definition of it?
Yeah. So fear or hatred of foreigners or people from other cultures or strangers. It is really sad that this is a word that is being looked up a lot. The editors at Dictionary.com are careful to say, we don't know why people are looking it up. It could be to check the spelling. It could be to check the meaning. It could be to send the definition to a friend. But it does mean that this is something we're thinking about, talking about, worrying about. It is something we should be worrying about. There, according to Dictionary.com, there was a big spike in 2015 after the attacks on foreign workers in South Africa and the rise of xenophobia in South Africa. And they say, you know, we can see that xenophobia is a worldwide phenomenon. And then with Brexit and then the U.S. presidential election, there's been a lot of talk about xenophobia.
We're talking about the words of the year. Do you have any hints for us what the American Dialect Society might be thinking about?
There are a few things floating around. It's hard to believe that political words won't be a big part of our discussion, too. We actually have a category this year called Political Word of the Year, so perhaps we can isolate them into their own category. I know.
Good luck with that.
My colleague Alan Metcalf has put out the suggestion of microaggression for the word of the year. Again, something we're talking a lot about. I have a friend who is a big advocate for normalize as the word of the year. It's not a new word, but it is something that I think, again, we've been talking a lot about in terms of our concerns about what may be getting normalized in our discourse and in our culture.
University of Michigan English professor Ann Curzan studies linguistics and the history of the English language, and she's the co-host of That's What They Say here on Michigan Radio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Lester.
And in case you're wondering, Merriam-Webster's word of the year is surreal. They say because it was looked up more frequently by users in 2016 than any other year. They define surreal as marked by the intense, irrational reality of a dream. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the Flint water disaster began to unfold, it took the combined efforts of activist scientists and activist citizens to smash the wall of indifference, scorn, and stonewalling erected by local, state, and EPA officials. Those who spoke out were faced with a torrent of scorn from peers and superiors. EPA lead and water expert Miguel Del Toro, Virginia Tech engineering professor Mark Edwards, and Flint residents like Leanne Walters. Continuing now with my conversation with Mark Edwards and Leanne Walters, we sat down together last week on the one-year anniversary of the declaration of emergency in Flint, the day officials truly confirmed the scope of what the world knows now as the Flint water crisis.
How has this experience changed you?
I work on water problems pretty much 24/7. It has completely turned my life upside down. I work a lot of 18, 20-hour days while still taking care of my family. So if you'd have said to me 5 years ago, this would be my life, I'd have laughed in your face. But I've met a lot of amazing people along the way. I've taught myself a tremendous amount. I've been taught a tremendous amount. I've had the greatest mentors in Mark and Miguel. I couldn't ask for better mentors than this. And, I mean, it sucks that it had to happen. One of the things that used to get me in trouble a lot growing up is my bluntness. And, I mean, a lot of trouble at times. But, you know, it's come in very handy. It's been one of my best assets in this fight. So at least it serves a good purpose now.
How about you, Mark? How has it changed you?
Well, let me just say it's been so inspirational working with Leanne. So I don't think people realize. I mean, she had figured out how to protect her family, and she has fought ever since to protect children, other people's children, not only in Flint but around the country. And she's done it without a penny of compensation. Believe me, I've tried to get her funding from EPA because of the great work that she and other residents have been doing since to monitor the quality of water. And she has refused to take even a penny of money because she doesn't want it to appear to be a conflict of interest. And so I see my colleagues so worried about their research funding, and here's this amazing woman and not financially well off, but has such high standards of integrity. And, personally, I found this whole story so inspirational. It's kind of the end of the journey for me because it's kind of shown I wasn't crazy all those years, which certain people said I was. And, you know, it's a little bit of a relief that this time we actually got kids protected. And through the amazing advocacy of Dr. Mona and Michigan's congressional delegation and even Governor Snyder's help, I mean, just look at all the relief and all the help that they're going to be getting to deal with the health problems and also to kind of have a chance to rebuild their infrastructure. And if we play our cards right, maybe even get water rates affordable in Flint.
Once the word began to spread early this year about the crisis in Flint, you saw a lot of big names in politics and in show business. We talked to Cher. She was one of the first big names, and I remember talking to her because she'd seen it on Rachel Maddow's show, and she was so fired up about what was happening in Flint. So much attention. Certainly big political names, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, President-elect Trump, making their way to Flint. Yet it took all year to get a penny of federal funding through Congress. Finally it happened, that $170 million federal aid package. But I wondered, how did you feel about Flint being used as kind of a backdrop during the campaign?
I was disgusted by it. I did not like some of the moves that were done within our city. I don't feel that our city should have taken a side one way or the other. If we expect Congress to work bipartisan, why would you not expect that in the city that needs the greatest amount of help?
Well, as usual, I'm going to try to find the silver lining here. And I think that, you know, it's amazing once this environmental injustice was exposed just how many people did care. And you talk about common morality, and there's something that happened in this tragedy that makes everyone in America angry. And that litany of folks who got involved just illustrates that. So I think we have had some bipartisanship here. People tend to overlook that. Your first inclination is to point to the other side, to the other tribe is at fault. And when in reality, it was career civil servants who messed this problem up in a culture created nationally by the US EPA. That's perfectly clear to me. And so my faith has been restored, oddly enough, even in politicians. That's how bad Flint was. Really, I've been very impressed by the political response, both Michigan state legislators and even the governor.
I think that the one thing that we're forgetting about as we're saying this, though, is that we still need adult health care for Flint residents. They are the forgotten community in this, and there are some adults that have been severely affected by this, and that's the one thing that hasn't been really truly addressed that really does need to be addressed. I mean, we've been up to D.C. about it numerous times trying to figure it out. We've been through the state of Michigan. We went talked with the state for 7 months trying to figure it out for anybody over the age of 21, and we're not there yet.
So the fight has to continue.
Well, yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there are people that are financially struggling because of what was done to them and not getting any assistance. And we also need to address the mental health issues that are now in place. There's a PTSD mentality from what's happened, and rightfully so. So, I mean, that's the other part of this that still needs to be dealt with as we move forward in this. I mean, I appreciate what's being done as far as the funding that has come through now, but living through it day to day and being in it, waiting a year for it, doesn't seem right. I understand that it was declared a man-made disaster, but it was not at our own hands. So if it was a natural disaster, the funding would have come in a lot sooner, and there would have been a lot more assistance than what was given. And I think that's what really hurt us, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed going forward. If something like this happens in the future, who's responsible when it's considered man-made, and how do we get the funding sooner rather than later?
Mark, when that January meeting happens at the EPA office in Chicago, are you expecting a declaration the water is technically safe to drink? What do you expect to come out of that?
Well, I think based on our own monitoring that we've looked at almost everything you could, disinfection byproducts. We had two independent teams looking at it. We've looked at bacterial issues. We looked at corrosion-causing bacteria. We've looked at the lead, the other metals. And from every dimension of performance, the water quality is just so dramatically improved. But again, recognizing that the bar has been set very, very high here, it's not a decision, you know, I'm going to make. It's going to require consensus that this is the way to go. And there is no precedent. There is no roadmap. Like in a prior hurricane, for example, you leave town after A, B, C, and D and E are done. Mm-hmm. But I think given that, you know, again, I think that the FEMA folks and the EPA and the state, they've all done a really good job.
So now we kind of look ahead into the new year, and is it going to be kind of a, for lack of a better word, a messy transition? Are people going to accept, okay, the water is technically within federal safety standards, that not so much the front page, front burner emergency situation? Is that going to be hard for people in Flint to accept that?
I think so.
Why?
Well, I mean, I live 2 weeks in Flint, 2 weeks in Virginia, mm-hmm. and I don't trust the water anywhere. So it's not, I don't think it's something that people are going to get over that easily. I mean, and we're not done yet because the lead and copper rule isn't fixed. We still have a huge, you know, battle in front of us.
The rule that Governor Snyder called dumb, right? The standards.
Right. And actually, yeah, Michigan's now is heading towards having the toughest lead and copper rule in the world. And hopefully other states will adopt that, because when it comes to, you know, the US EPA has just proven itself completely incapable. I have no hope that the EPA is going to come up with a better lead and copper rule.
How much, we've talked about the fact that there's zero trust happening with people in Flint to anything said by anybody in authority, so to speak. How does that distrust ever get fixed? Should it be fixed?
It should be fixed to a point. I don't think, you know, we're raised here to trust our government. These people are paid to protect us. And, I mean, it's a huge lesson that was learned in Flint for what has happened. There needs to be some type of trust rebuilt. I don't think it's ever going to be at the level of what it was for most people after what we've been through. I know it won't be for me.
Because you kind of wonder what kind of city, state, and nation it will be if people feel that they're being lied to and dismissed and patronized by people who are our leaders. Where do we go when people feel that way?
Well, we're here where we are right now, you know, after this election. And, you know, so I think for some folks, once burnt, forever shy. There's no going back, and you can't blame them. But, you know, we have to go on anyway.
Leanne, what should we all learn from what Dr. Mark Edwards did when you reached out?
Well, I think it's such a really good example of citizen and scientist working together, and the kind of scientist Mark is, he's a person to person, not a, I'm a scientist and you're just a citizen. There wasn't dismissive remarks or demeaning anything coming out of him. It was listening and working together to get the job done. And that's something that I personally feel is lacking. And I think it just sets a really good example that it can be done and there needs to be more of it, because I really think we could really get a lot of things accomplished with this.
And I'm going to flip the coin around, Mark. What should we learn from Leanne Walters and Melissa Mays and the other activist citizens in Flint?
Well, just don't give up. And secondly, if you think something's wrong, do your homework, like Leanne did. When she came to me, as I said, all the scientific work was done, because she laid out an airtight case, and Miguel seconded that with his memo. And the only thing left to do was to pull off this miracle, which was to get this dream team together and everyone playing their roles and essentially overthrow a few branches of government to get Flint kids protected. So I think for anyone who was involved in that fight, they all realized just how lucky we were to have each other at the right time, the right place. And again, I shudder to think what would have happened to Flint and now the rest of the country if this miracle had not occurred.
How's your family now? How are your kids doing?
My kids are dealing with health issues, things that have come out over the last year. They have hand-eye coordination issues and severe speech impairments that we're working on. They've developed some of the behavioral issues with the lack of impulse control. And Gavin, the one that was diagnosed with lead poisoning, he's not growing properly, and he hasn't been for the last 2 years. He's 39 pounds to his twin's 67 pounds. There's such a huge height and weight difference that people don't realize that they're twins. And it grows more and more each day.
So you're confronted with this every single day as you hold your kids.
Yes. We deal with this on a daily basis. But I won't allow my children to have a victim mentality. I work very hard to make sure they have a survivor mentality.
Do either of you, Mark, you mentioned being kind of the end of the journey. Do you see yourselves stepping away from the front line of activism and passing the torch to others?
Activism is always a last resort for me, so I take that coat off as soon as I possibly can and, you know, try to revert to my role as a scientist, which is about seeking the truth and, you know, where your brand is trust. And again, what we've got to do is restore trust in science and engineering, which was badly betrayed here. So in the classroom, you know, I teach an ethics class. We'll probably teach that nationally next year. But I'm all too eager to go back to my role as just being a scientist. It's truly a last resort for me. It's very, very painful. But, you know, it had to be done.
Now, if you got a call from Leanne Walters from another city, would you answer it?
I generally answer all phone calls. And, you know, 98% of the time, it's something simple. But 2% of the time, you're going, wow, that could be the next Flint. And unfortunately, for the last year, I mean, I've had more than a full-time job just dealing with one person, one man-made disaster, I guess you'd call it. So it does make you uneasy, and it makes you realize we need a mechanism to police the environmental policemen in this country. You know, we've seen it with policing of cities where the trust was there and the police became the criminals, and that's clearly the situation we have now. It would be best if everyone did their job and you could trust everyone, but that's not the world we live in. So Leanne and I and others have discussed, you know, what one might do to try to restore trust and expose these environmental injustices when they occur.
When will the water be normal in Flint?
I think the water probably is normal now, but the trust in the water will never, ever be restored. Leanne has told me, as have many rational, highly educated people, they will never again drink tap water. They will never trust water from a filter. They will never trust water from a shower. And I can't blame them. I'm not. It's not my job to try to change their mind, given what they've gone through. So I think the fact certain people will never trust it, that's an entirely expected and rational response. And in prior disasters I've been involved in, some folks were never trusting of the water again.
Okay, but in my defense to this, Flint was severely damaging to us. When we got restationed to Virginia, we were willing to give it a shot. Still weren't willing to give the regular normal showers a shot, but we had considered drinking it until we had it tested. And then once we had it tested and it was over the action level, that was enough for me. I will never trust a water source again just because I'm told to.
Well, and look nationally, trust in our drinking water supplies had never been lower with good reason. Last year, bottled water sales exceeded soda sales for the first time because of Flint. And so if you ever wanted to destroy trust in your product, drinking water, this would be the road that you would go, literally, working hard to tell people their water is safe when it's not, and then see it unfold all around the country, this lead in schools, lead in this city, lead in that city. Now it's lead in rural America, front page USA Today.
I think it would be a huge step in Flint, though, if we could get the entire infrastructure replaced, not just pulling out the lead service lines, but taking care of the mains that are breaking. I think that would be, and you know, making the system a smaller system like it needs to be for the lack of people that it's set up for. I mean, it's set up for a way larger city than we are now. And I think if we got that infrastructure taken care of, I think that would be a good, huge first step in trying to restore trust in the water.
Leanne Walters, mom and Flint activist, and Mark Edwards, Virginia Tech professor of civil and environmental engineering. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Listen to my entire interview with Mark and Leanne over at MichiganRadio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.